Coming up 15 years after the attacks of 9/11, Kim Lawton talks to religious leaders about their vision for interfaith relations. Also, a Fred DeSam Lazaro story on a country that welcomes even the most needy refugees. Plus, with some 2 million Muslim pilgrims at the Hajj in Mecca, we visit an event where children learn about the rituals being performed.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. This time of year of many anniversaries. It's the 15th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, and we mark the 20th season of this program covering the news of all religions. We'll have more on 9/11 later. Some 2 million Muslim pilgrims are in Saudi Arabia for the annual Hajj, or pilgrimage to Mecca. The Hajj is one of the five pillars of Islam, and all Muslims are called to perform it at least once in their lifetime if they're able to do so. Saudi officials have strengthened security and crowd management after last year's deadly stampede. The Saudi government says 769 people were killed, but other estimates put the death toll at over 2,400. Iran has strongly criticized Saudi Arabia's handling of the tragedy, and Iranian pilgrims are not taking part in this year's Hajj. Saudi Arabia has accused Iran of politicizing the sacred event. A suspected chlorine gas attack in Aleppo, Syria, has made more than 120 people sick, including dozens of children. At least one man died in this week's attack. The Syrian Civil Defense, a rescue workers group, said government helicopters dropped barrel bombs containing chlorine. The Syrian government and rebels have accused each other of using chlorine as a weapon of war. The attack comes 3 years after the Syrian government agreed to give up its chemical weapons. Several organizations gathered in Washington this week to call attention to the plight of Christians in the Middle East. In Defense of Christians, the Armenian National Committee of America, and other groups called on U.S. lawmakers to press for a safe region in Iraq for religious minorities. The initiative seeks to establish a province there for persecuted Christians, Yazidis, and other minority groups. In other news, the largest gathering of Native American tribes in more than a century protested the construction of a proposed oil pipeline in North Dakota. The 1,100-mile pipeline would be the first to transport crude oil directly from North Dakota to refineries on the U.S. Gulf Coast. Native Americans are outraged that the pipeline would cross ancient burial and prayer sites. They also fear a rupture of the pipeline could pollute the Missouri River, the main source of their drinking water. For many people around the country, the attacks of 9/11 spurred a new interest in interfaith dialogue. Kim Lawton talks with two religious leaders who were both students in New York on 9/11. They describe how that event and its aftermath profoundly shaped what they now see as their mission in life, to promote a new vision for interfaith relations face to face.
Like many Americans, New York University chaplains Imam Khalid Latif and Rabbi Yehuda Sarna remember exactly where they were on that morning 15 years ago.
I was an undergrad at New York University on September 11th in 2001.
Latif was a sophomore and had just arrived for Arabic class when a security guard came and told the students to evacuate. They went to nearby Washington Square Park, where thousands had gathered to watch the fire at the World Trade Center.
There's a lot of noise, there was a lot of commotion. People were trying to figure out what was going on. And all of a sudden, we were hit by this very heavy silence as we watched the second plane fly into the towers. It felt like an eternity, but it was really just seconds.
Sarna was also in New York at the library of Yeshiva University when the towers fell.
I was in rabbinical school at Yeshiva University and doing my internship at a synagogue in Riverdale. The senior rabbi of the congregation, Rabbi Avi Weiss, was known to try to bring healing to places and situations of great distress.
Weiss went to the Ground Zero area. He invited Sarna to come with him.
I watched as he went over to the people who looked the most despondent, tired, grieving, and he just hugged them. And he said, I'm here, I'm a rabbi, I'm just here to say God bless you. That was the moment where I received my ordination. It's about human connection. So I would say 9/11 was very foundational for what I see as my life's mission.
Latif says the events of 9/11 were pivotal in shaping his mission as well. In the aftermath of the attacks, he and other Muslims felt a backlash of blame.
My father said, you know, we'd be more comfortable if you didn't cover your head anymore. You weren't visibly identifiable as a Muslim. I didn't understand why at a time when people had so many questions, many of us were taking steps back to not answer their questions.
He says support from friends of other faiths gave him the courage to speak out about his Muslim beliefs.
I, along with many of my classmates at that time, we just made a decision to be more proactive, to tell people this is what we believe in, this is who we are, this is what our values actually are.
Today, Latif and Sarna are leaders at NYU's Global Center for Academic and Spiritual Life, which has become a national model for university interfaith programs.
My community was very much like in our own Muslim bubble, so everyone I was interacting with was definitely Muslim. But interacting with people from different religious faiths, like I never really did that.
At NYU, students are encouraged to attend each other's religious services in projects like the Muslim-Jewish Juma Shabbat experience. Senior Sana Mayat says that has enhanced her own Islamic practice.
And I really love the concept of Shabbat. I really love the idea of it. I think it's like a really beautiful thing to kind of disconnect and tune everything out and really center yourself in what is important. I pray five times a day, so that's five times a day where I'm supposed to tune everything out and really concentrate on prayer and God and like what's important. But like, how invested am I in that I'm still not thinking about, you know, that text message I got on my phone or like that email that I have to send.
There are interfaith clubs to foster dialogue, and there are joint service projects, such as when students of different religious backgrounds came together to help rebuild homes after Hurricane Katrina and after recent tornadoes.
What we found is that those kinds of disasters don't just knock down homes, but they can break down barriers. And the experience of acting out on a shared value really bonds people.
When you're sitting and painting a wall for 10 hours, you're going to talk to the person next to you, and you have a common goal and a common mission, and you get to ask questions, and you just relate to people as people.
The leaders say they're trying to promote a new vision of interfaith relations.
Interfaith interaction today can't be what many of us have done with it in the past, where it's just a panel discussion, people getting up on a stage, talking about similarities for an hour, and then everybody goes back to their own homes.
We're concerned not about what it says in the books, but what people are saying in the street. And therefore, the kind of engagement that we're looking for is very much personal, face-to-face.
The two men model that in their own close personal friendship. When Latif got married 5 years ago, it was on the Jewish Sabbath, so Sarna, who's an Orthodox Jew, walked more than 80 blocks to be there. Today they live with their families in the same building.
Our wives are friends, our children are friends. We, at one point, even shared a nanny. Our kids, my children, don't know anything different.
I think my own relationship with God has been heavily impacted by his relationship with his faith and his relationship with God.
You can be deeply embedded and enriched by a religious community and still be excited about collaborating with people who are of a different faith community.
The Muslims love Khalid, and the Jewish community loves Rabbi Sarna. So when you see the two people we love like most like coming together, it just opens up opportunity for everyone else.
They embody everything that like the student groups are trying to do.
Latif and Sarna believe having strong relationships makes it possible to confront difficult issues such as religion and terrorism or the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
We don't believe in avoiding difficult conversations. We believe that difficult conversations are best had between friends.
You gain a level of respect for someone and you know someone. So it's hard to be resentful of someone's opinions. It's hard to argue when you know a little bit about someone's family. It promotes a better dialogue.
In their work, Latif and Sarna say the lessons of 9/11 are still very evident. Last year, during Pope Francis's visit to the U.S., Latif helped lead the interfaith service at the 9/11 memorial.
Through our knowing of each other today, let us move beyond a mere toleration of our differences and work towards a much-needed celebration of them.
15 years after 9/11, both leaders say they're concerned that divisions and anti-religious bigotry seem to be on the rise in many areas.
It's a return of a kind of hateful rhetoric that we thought we had buried. We thought it was over. It's very sad. It's scary. But for me, it's more sad than scary.
Still, Sarna says the current climate has renewed their purpose of helping young people find a different way of doing interfaith relations.
There are so many young people who are raring to go. They want to do this.
For many, it's like, well, where do I start? And, you know, your starting can just be with one other person. You might not impact a million people or 10 million people, but if you can bring good just to one individual, you can impact one heart, that can make all the difference.
And they say that can bring hope to a world forever changed by 9/11. I'm Kim Lawton in New York.
For all the world's refugees, 65 million at last count, homeless, jobless, struggling to find safety and shelter, Uganda in East Africa may be among the most welcoming. Fred DeSam Lazaro went there recently for this report on how the refugees have settled in.
Nakivale in southern Uganda looks like any other dusty rural African town. What's remarkable is that almost none of its 113,000 residents is Ugandan.
Ethiopia.
All of these schoolchildren and their parents are refugees.
Congo.
All told, 13 nations are represented in this crowded school, their families fleeing conflicts across a wide swath of East Africa and finding haven in what must rank as one of the world's most hospitable countries to refugees.
In Uganda, refugees are placed in settlements and not camps, and the government says there's an important difference. Camps tend to confine people. Whereas in Uganda, when refugees arrive, they're issued legal IDs that entitle them to move freely anywhere in the country, to find a job, start a business, put their children in school.
Refugees in rural areas are given a small plot of land to farm. Others migrate to the urban areas. Somalis are among the earlier arrivals in recent years. Their enclaves in the capital, Kampala, are well established with small businesses and mosques, a predominantly Muslim community in a mostly Christian nation. Mohammed Abdi runs this grocery store with his partner, Zahara Hassan.
We have many Ugandan customers and we are friends. I am one of the Somali elders in the community and we interact with the elders of the Ugandan community, whether leaders in this district or region, and we are friends and they welcome us. We are very happy. We're like one.
And one scholar who studied refugees in Uganda says there's reason to be happy.
We showed in the capital city of Uganda, Kampala, 20% of refugees own businesses that employ someone else. And of those they employ, 40% are citizens of the host country. So refugees can contribute to the host societies that they're part of.
Oxford University's Alexander Betts says Uganda is the exception in a world where refugees face widespread hostility, often stoked by politicians.
It's all too easy to have a race to the bottom in terms of political standards where provincial and municipal politicians or national politicians say, these people are a burden, we have to keep them out.
And while many politicians, especially in Western democracies, must tread carefully on this issue, Beth says it's not a problem in Uganda, where one man rules virtually unchallenged.
President Museveni has been able to adopt refugee policies that are a little different, in part because there are lower standards of accountability to the public. Now, not having democratic standards is definitely not something to celebrate, but it highlights the difficulties for democracies to open up their economies to non-citizens. It's a hard thing for politicians.
Recent history might also account for Uganda's hospitality to refugees. President Yoweri Museveni himself lived in exile for years during and after the bloody dictatorship of Idi Amin. Museveni's rebels took power 30 years ago.
There's been a history of violence in this region.
Zach Niringia is a bishop in the Anglican Church of Uganda.
South Sudan, Rwanda, Burundi, even Congo, and even Uganda. But I think that that has created a sense of being hospitable, because you never know, it may be your turn next.
Despite praise for its hospitality, life in Uganda is far from perfect for refugees. Their number has doubled in the past 5 years or so to more than 500,000, most recently from separate conflicts in Burundi and South Sudan.
Uganda is good because that gives us security. Most of the time we don't hear the guns like that.
Kilume Zizi is grateful to have escaped the violence in his native Congo, where he had a small business in household goods. He hasn't been able to re-establish here and barely scrapes by on minimal food rations for his wife and 5 children.
And you get 1 kilogram per person?
Yeah, 2 cups.
2 cups?
Yeah, that's okay, 1 kilogram.
For how long?
That's 1 month.
Many refugees, like Ababesh Gebrselassie, remain haunted by the ordeal that brought them here.
One day,
my husband was killed, my son was killed, and also my daughter.
A son and daughter died in their escape from Eritrea, part of the exodus of hundreds of thousands from a country notorious for human rights abuses. Her son-in-law made it to Libya, but died in the Mediterranean. Gebrselassie survived the journey of thousands of miles on foot and on trucks with her then 6-year-old twin son and daughter. But she made a wrenching decision to leave 2 older teenage children behind.
I feared that we all would die, like my son who was shot. I left them so that our family can survive, can be represented.
They are still there now.
I don't know.
Along the way, she also took custody of her orphaned granddaughter, Sarah, who's now 4.
I don't care if I die here, but I want a better future for my children, and that's not possible without a good education.
That's not likely in the crowded school her children attend, with 120 students in each classroom, and perhaps because of that, teachers who aren't very sympathetic. There are severe consequences for being late, for instance. They beat you.
Yes, they beat
Who beats you?
The teachers, when they say that you pick the rubbishes, if we will come late, we wash the toilets.
So if you're late, you have to wash the toilets?
Yes.
They don't understand, she said, that I'm late because I've gone to fetch water and helped my mother with the chores. In the end, Ugandan and international officials say it boils down to resources or a lack of them. Uganda may be hospitable, but it has a gross domestic product of just $600 per year per person. Nakivale School is funded by the UN's Refugee Agency. It gives Uganda some $200 million annually in refugee aid, a fraction of what's needed, but not likely to increase amid the demands on donor governments for refugees out of Syria, Iraq, Ukraine, and elsewhere. Charles Yaxley is the UN agency's spokesman in Uganda.
Around the world, humanitarian financing is arguably at breaking point. Currently, humanitarian appeals for South Sudanese and Burundian refugees in Uganda, both of those appeals are severely underfunded. We've received less than 1/4 of the money we need for 2016. And that leaves real gaps in our humanitarian response. It means we're not able to provide the educational support to the children, such as better schools, more teachers.
That does not bode well for the future of Abibesh Gebrselassie's twins, who shared their dreams in halting, shy English. What would you like to do when you grow up?
When I grow up, I want to be a doctor and to help my mother.
How about you, David? What would you like to do when you grow up?
I wish to be a pilot, man.
You want to be a pilot?
Yeah.
Yes. Where would you like to go?
I would go every place, like America, like that, everywhere.
America and everywhere?
Yeah.
Possible, but like their chance of a good education here, with lottery-like odds. America admitted 70,000 refugees last year. The UN says there are 65 million displaced people in the world today. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred de Sam Lazaro in Nakivale, Uganda.
Excerpts of retired Pope Benedict XVI's new book, Last Testament, in his own words, have been published in an Italian newspaper and a German weekly. In the book, Benedict acknowledges that governing the Catholic Church was not his strong suit, but says he does not consider his papacy a failure. Benedict also says he was shocked and a little uncertain when his successor, Pope Francis, was elected, but that he has since been very pleased with Francis's papacy. Conservative leader Phyllis Schlafly died on Monday. She was 92. Schlafly was active in politics for decades. She recently endorsed Donald Trump for president and was a delegate to the Republican National Convention in July. Over her career, she led grassroots campaigns against communism and abortion and also helped defeat the Equal Rights Amendment. Schlafly was Roman Catholic and spoke out against gay rights, even after one of her sons acknowledged he is homosexual. On our calendar, for Muslims, this week marks one of their most important holidays, Eid al-Adha, the Festival of the Sacrifice. The day commemorates Abraham's willingness to sacrifice his son. While Jews and Christians believe that son was Isaac, in Islamic tradition, it was Ishmael. The Eid comes at the height of the Hajj in Mecca, where pilgrims are performing a series of special rituals. We visited the Dar al-Hijra Islamic Center in Falls Church, Virginia, where children participated in an educational mock Hajj. Imam Johari Abdul Malik explained the pilgrimage and the rituals associated with it.
The journey to this house once in your lifetime is, in the Islamic tradition, a requirement. And so people will leave their familiar and they will come to this house established by Abraham. But 6 million people cannot fit inside this house, and so people will pray around the house. Seven circuits around the Kaaba is the tradition. When Hagar was left in Mecca by Abraham with her baby, she was looking for water. The angel came and sprung a well, and it is a kind of holy water. Then they will run between the hills of Safa and Marwa in the way that Hagar did. Mina is a tent city, and they will live in this tent and perform 5 daily prayers. The Prophet Muhammad, when he made his pilgrimage, he came to the top of this hill. He gave his final sermon. It is the belief that after one completes this day on Arafah, that all of your sins are forgiven. The Prophet instructed his companions to collect some pebbles, and the next morning after Arafah, come and throw symbolically their pebble, like Abraham threw at the devil when he was tempted. While we are in Mina throwing our stones, people in Mecca are celebrating Eid. It's like Thanksgiving on steroids. We sacrifice a sheep and we give that food to the needy around our planet. My Hajj is not valid unless I make the sacrifice.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, music from last year's 9/11 memorial service with Pope Francis, where an interfaith children's choir sang, "Let There Be Peace on Earth."
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.